thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR. I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's been having a voice treatment, but she'll be back on Monday. More than 9,000 additives are in the food supply. They range from seaweed extract to chemical flavorings. But consumer advocates warn that in many cases, companies certify the safety of these substances without any FDA oversight. With me here in the studio to talk about food additives, health concerns, and new pressure for more oversight, we have Michael Taylor with the FDA, Kimberly Kindy with the Washington Post, Eric Olson with the National Resources Defense Council, and Amelia Leonardo with the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Thanks to all of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So this is a show about what you consume, so you all need to be part of the discussion. You can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. You can send in comments or you can send in questions with Facebook or Twitter. Michael Taylor from the FDA, let's start with you. Let's talk about how the process is supposed to work when new ingredients are added to the food supply. What, in theory, is the way that a new additive should be dealt with?
Yeah. First, Tom, let me just say we really appreciate a chance to have this conversation, and we appreciate the attention that our program is getting.
Mm-hmm.
The framework for the way the system works really goes back 56 years to a law that Congress passed to address the safety of food additives, chemicals, and other substances being added to food. And the idea there was to create a pre-market approval system. This was in response to changes that were happening in the food supply. Chemical technology was being developed and applied to food processing and production in new ways. And there was a consensus then and that we really needed to have a system that would ensure that the decisions about entry into these chemicals into the marketplace would be made objectively. They'd be made rigorously in terms of a proper standard and adequate data to judge safety, and that they would be transparent, that the public would know the basis for these decisions. And so the 1958 law created a pre-market approval system for the first time, which would have FDA, you know, making the decisions under a congressionally prescribed safety standard and with the basis for those decisions in the public domain.
For each and every additive?
Well, for each and every food additive, and this is the wrinkle that I think creates much of today's controversy, Congress built into the definition of food additive and thus into the determination of what substances required this pre-market review by FDA, the so-called generally recognized as safe concept. So substances that are judged generally recognized as safe are not legally food additives, and they can remain in food or be added to food without any FDA review. It's important, if I can just take a moment, to kind of lay the foundation for our discussion, because to understand what this so-called generally recognized as safe concept is, the acronym is GRAS. We may use that term, but it stands for generally recognized as safe. It was primarily a measure for Congress to say, as a practical matter, many chemicals and many food ingredients have been used for decades. Scientists agree they're safe. There's no need to go back and reestablish their safety. And so Congress, we think prudently, said these don't need to go through a formal FDA review. But this provision was also written so that new substances or new uses of old substances could come into the market if the companies judge them to be generally recognized as safe. So that's where it gets complicated, you know, because chemicals, and in fact, the majority of new uses and new uses of chemicals are coming into the food supply based upon these company determinations.
Okay, Kimberly Kindy, take it from there. So Congress creates this exception, and what happens? Michael Taylor just said that the FDA view was this was a prudent move by Congress,
right.
But what happened?
Well, there's some debate over exactly what the congressional intent was when it comes to generally recognized as safe. Certainly, they were recognizing that vinegar, baking soda, a number of things that have been in the food supply for a very long time and for which there's very well-established science, as you know, in terms of its safety, that those things shouldn't go through a super strict formal review process by the FDA. But I don't think that what they envisioned and what has happened, I think those things are totally different. The bottom line is, we don't know about many of the chemicals that are in our food now. When it comes to generally recognized as safe, The regulations that FDA put together after the 1958 law allowed people, companies, to go off and do their science and not reveal it either to the FDA or publicly. And it was written in a way that was so vague that we don't have them publishing their science in places where the FDA can review it or the public can review it or even the scientific community can review it. It is eroded to the point where you have companies that are approving chemicals on their own with one company employee sometimes saying that it's safe and publishing it sometimes in an internal newsletter. That's their definition of public science. And FDA is never notified about it. So nobody is reviewing the science, not the scientific community, not outside, not people outside of that company, and not the FDA.
Well, Eric Olson, as a result of that, how much of this, the problem here is uncertainty, which is what Kimberly Kindy is talking about, or do we now know that some unsafe substances have actually entered the food supply as a result of this lack of review?
We are worried that there are unsafe substances that have entered the food supply because of a lack of FDA review. We've issued a series of reports that have highlighted some of those. And amazingly, in some cases, the companies were looking for some advantage in the marketplace, and they asked FDA to take a look at their additive. FDA raised questions. They withdrew their request for FDA approval, and then these chemicals ended up in the food supply anyway. So that's an extreme example. But there are many other chemicals that over the years have crept into the food supply, and we read about them in the newspapers all the time, chemicals ranging from phthalates to perchlorate to bisphenol A, et cetera. There are a lot of them that are either have been self-approved as GRAS or that have been approved many, many years ago without review since then. So this generally recognized as safe concept is certainly one of the central problems where the companies that have a clear conflict of interest can make their own secret determination that something is safe without telling FDA. That's not a regulatory program, and it needs to be fixed.
Well, Emilio Leonardo, you are Vice President of Consumer Product Safety at the Grocery Manufacturers Association. From your point of view and from your association's point of view, how did this situation develop? I mean, are you just not able to take all your research to the FDA, or are you not asked to, or what happens?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Our members, the food industry, is committed to produce safe and affordable foods. Mm-hmm. And good companies have a long history of producing safe food and innovative food. And in part, it's due to the generally recognized as safe criteria and process.
And how does that? Why does that make it easier to create innovative foods, like you say?
Generally recognized as safe is these ingredients have been on the science has been available for some time because it's publicly available. It is not generally recognized unless the science is available and it's reviewed by experts. Dossiers are prepared. The science is available. There's nothing secret about it. Once an ingredient enters the food supply, it is placed on the label. So if you pull the label, you will see, you know, we really encourage our consumers to read the label. Mm-hmm. You will see the ingredient on the label. The information on safety on that ingredient is publicly available if it went through the generally recognized as safe criteria.
But isn't it true that sometimes these ingredients identified in the label are identified only in pretty generic ways and not the actual chemical that is being added?
Yes, that is true. However, it's very easy to find that chemical name from that ingredient. You can also feel free to call the company. The consumer centers at these companies can be very helpful to a consumer. We understand that consumer confidence is the most important thing in addition to safety on these products. And so GMA, the Grocery Manufacturers mm-hmm. Association, together with other industry stakeholders, have initiated a five-part strategy to help bring transparency of the process to all stakeholders. I think that's going to be very important to bring consumer confidence and understand that this is a robust process.
And I'm going to give you the opportunity to explain some of the stages in that process. But back to you first, Michael Taylor, from the FDA. You said in the beginning that the FDA view was that the creation of this generally recognized as safe waiver, if that was the proper term, was a prudent move from your agency's point of view. How do you feel now? Do you feel satisfied with the process that exists now?
No, we don't. I think the construct recognizing that there's some substances in food that have a history of use in food don't require further FDA review. There's some prudence to that as a practical kind of resource matter. But no, the way this concept has played out, this legal, and it is. I just have to clarify Kimberly's point. Congress created the generally recognized as safe construct and created the legal option for companies to make these decisions on their own, subject to our having to then go and prove that the substance is not generally recognized as safe. So that's a statutory thing, and I think it's important to know that because when we think about fixes to the problem, and there is a need for fixes to the problem. You know, we've got to look both at what FDA can do and what Congress might want to do if it considers this to be worthy of attention. But no, we are concerned that we are not hearing about, we are not being notified about substances being added to food. We have a program that encourages notification on a voluntary basis, and we get in the realm of 30 or 40 notifications a year. Over time, about 20% of those aren't successful, which says to us, meaning we either reject it or the notification is withdrawn. So what's happening with the ones we don't hear about?
Michael Taylor is from the FDA, where he's Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about food additives and the FDA's role in overseeing them. I'm going to take a short break right here. Stay tuned. Hello again. I'm Tom Gelton. I'm sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and we're talking about additives in our food supply and the role of the FDA in overseeing the placement of those additives and ensuring the safety of those additives. My guests all here in the studio are Michael Taylor from the FDA, also Kimberly Kindy, a national reporter with the Washington Post, Eric Olson, Senior Strategic Director for Health and Food at the National Natural Resources Defense Council, and Emilia Leonardo, Vice President of Consumer Product Safety and Science Policy for the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Eric Olson, just before the break, Michael was saying how few of the additives that get introduced into the food supply are actually reviewed at the FDA. Now, your agency actually carried out a Freedom of Information Act request in order to find out how often that is happening. And share with us what you've learned.
We did. We completed a study that asked the Food and Drug Administration for their records about chemicals that were proposed to be cleared by FDA. But we also looked in a wide variety of internal industry documents and reports, and we had evaluated over 275 chemicals from 56 companies that had been self-cleared by the companies without disclosure to the public, and without, in many cases, disclosure at all to FDA. We actually asked the companies for the underlying data that would support why they thought their chemical was generally recognized as safe. Most of them did not give us the underlying data. So it's hard for us to understand how something can be generally recognized as safe if the name of the chemical isn't public. The studies that supposedly are the basis of the finding that it was safe are not public, and FDA doesn't even know about it. How is that generally recognized as safe? It's simply not.
Well, I'm sure Emilia Lozano wants to respond to that. Before we get to that, Kimberly, I'm still a little unclear here. Who gets to decide whether something needs FDA approval or not? Who gets to decide whether something is, some additive is generally recognized as safe?
The food industry does. If they decide that they want to do a self-determination that something is generally recognized as safe, they can go off and do that and never notify the FDA. In fact,
is that what Congress, is that flow directly from the legislation?
I think that you would have to go back and probably talk to members of Congress in 1958, but there's nothing in the legislative history that suggests that they felt that new novel ingredients, in fact, it explicitly says that new novel ingredients or ingredients that are used in new and novel ways, they absolutely were not supposed to end up in the generally recognized as safe category. They absolutely were not supposed to be ingredients that food companies on their own determined were safe. And I would actually very much take exception with the fact with what was said about the science being public. I had the same exact experience as NRDC did. I looked at a new novel ingredient, a green tea extract that FDA actually looked at and raised major concerns about, and talked to two companies that went off, did their own self-determination on the safety of it, did not notify the FDA, and when I asked them for the science, the underlying science, for what determined that it was safe, they refused to give it to me. So this is not publicly available science, and this is not what was originally intended.
Well, Emilia Lozano, you did say earlier that this research is publicly available, but in saying that, you suggested, for example, that consumers may need to call up the company and find out what exactly is the ingredient that they're talking about and what is the research that makes them think it's safe. Is that really publicly available information? I mean, it sounds like it requires an awful lot of initiative on the part of a consumer.
The label will contain the name of the ingredient in the product.
Mm-hmm.
That is a requirement. So the ingredient is disclosed. If the consumer has questions regarding that specific ingredient, they can call the company. They are also free to contact the Grocery Manufacturers Association. I am happy to work with the consumer. The generally recognized as safe means exactly that, generally recognized as safe. Legitimate companies will follow the criteria as specified in the law. A panel of experts, these are toxicologists who are experts. Most of the time they are independent of the company. They will do a panel review. If these experts determine that this ingredient is not safe, the ingredient is not safe. It will not be used in the food supply. I understand that with all processes, there's always room for improvement. And it's been 56 years since this law has been in place. I do not know of any major issue that has a safety issue that has arisen from the food in a grass ingredient. The U.S. has one of the safest food supplies in the world. The grass process has served America well. And with the as time goes on, all processes can be improved, and we have initiative to improve that process.
But you said legitimate companies will seek legitimate experts to do this review, but there's no safeguards, it sounds like. I mean, what about illegitimate companies? And, you know, what do we as consumers, what kind of assurance do we have that this review process is actually a sound one? None, it sounds like.
FDA has the authority to remove any ingredient from the food supply or any product that they deem unsafe, that it is adulterated. FDA has done their job well, and they will remove ingredients and food from the food supply if the ingredient is not safe.
Michael Taylor, you're from the FDA. Are you satisfied with the recourses that you have?
We are limited in our practical ability to monitor the thousands of ingredients in the food supply, whether they've come in through an FDA approval process or the GRAS process. I mean, I think one of the keys here is that the uses of chemicals evolve over time. And one of the things that's happened with the application of the GRAS concept is that chemicals that may have been approved for one use are used for additional uses, so that you have a question of what's the cumulative exposure. You know, and we do not have information that permits us to systematically monitor that. And that's one of the major challenges under this law, which relies on our post-market oversight as opposed to a strong pre-market program.
Well, Kimberly, one of the things that has changed since 1958 is the use of food additives. I said in the intro, 9,000 food additives are now in the food supply. What explains this explosion in the use of food additives?
Well, it's at least 9,000. That's the number that can be identified. And there are a number of things that you see on the labels that are artificial ingredients, natural ingredients, or flavorings. We don't know what that chemical is. And so we know it's more than 9,000. But the reason why it's exploded so much is, you know, our love of processed foods. We want everything to be, you know, something you can microwave in a minute. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first it was, you know, junk food, and now it's this faux health food that you see. And what the manufacturers have learned is that if you add certain ingredients, you can take something that's low fat, that used to taste like cardboard, and make it have a pleasant texture and taste, and that there are certain ingredients that you can add that can do this. And they're always looking for new ones so that we can feel good about the food that we stick in the microwave or in the oven for a minute or two and eat it. But it's largely driven by the processed foods.
Well, as Amelia said, there's a natural reaction by industry to innovate and to produce new food products that do respond to these consumer interests. Eric Olson, Amelia was saying, pointing out that the FDA, in the end, does have the authority to remove additives that it considers unsafe. How effective is that authority?
To be blunt, completely ineffective. And there are several reasons for that. One is out of the 9,000 to 10,000 food additives, most of those are not required to be put on the label. The chemical name is not required to be put on the label for a variety of reasons.
Give us an example.
For example, artificial flavors or artificial some of the packaging materials, extracts, a lot of them are in generic terms, so the actual chemical name is not in there. Chemicals that are used upstream that end up in the food that are used to process it. There are literally thousands of these that are not actually disclosed on the label. So in addition, we believe that there are at least 1,000 of these self-determined chemicals that are generally recognized as safe based on some published information. So if FDA doesn't even know about the additive being put in the food supply, it's very difficult for FDA to then step in and say, we think this additive is unsafe, when they don't even know that it exists.
Well, Amelia, we've been talking about how the food industry has evolved and changed in these many years since this law was passed in 1958. Is the Grocery Manufacturers Association, your members, are you open to sort of revisiting some of these issues? Are you open to sort of revising some of the authorities or strengthening some of the authorities that the FDA has? Or are you insistent that it should just be up to the industry itself to deal with this issue?
Industry has worked hand in hand with FDA for many years, and we are committed to providing safe, quality food. We're also committed to working with the FDA. With the Food Safety Modernization Act that is in progress right now, the law has been passed. The food industry has revolutionized many different processes. And at this time, you know, we feel that it is an appropriate time to modernize the generally recognized as safe process as well. And we have met with FDA and had several discussions regarding this, and we have rolled out the five-part strategy.
And I believe that you, and as part of that strategy, you are providing the FDA with more of the underlying data that has led you to conclude that certain additives are safe.
Yes. The process remains the same. It will be more transparent. The information will be made more publicly available, not only to the consumer, but also to the FDA.
You know, one question that I have, Michael, is Michael Taylor from the FDA, is we've heard a lot in recent years about budget cutbacks at the FDA. What's the situation there now with regard to your staff resources, your research resources, you know, your ability to carry out the functions that your agency was given, was assigned when it was created?
Our resource situation is challenging, to say the least. The center within FDA that I oversee, the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, has about the same permanent staffing levels now as it had in the early 1990s. And everybody knows the massive changes in the food system, the increased complexity, the advances in technology that have occurred. And we have struggled to keep up with that. And that's part of the picture here because, again, in addition to the way the law is structured, there are practical limits on our ability with current resources to address some of these issues. So we've got to address both the policy side of this and the resource side of it if we're going to achieve what I think there's a lot of agreement we should be achieving, which is a level of oversight that assures people that that these ingredients are safe and that there's a basis for public confidence in these ingredients. You know, we don't feel like we have a public health crisis here with respect to chemical mm-hmm. additives, but we do have, I think, a legitimate set of questions being raised about the system of oversight and can people have confidence in it.
Michael Taylor from the FDA, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And a lot of callers are lining up with questions or complaints, maybe. Remember, our phone number is 1-800-433-8850, and we'll be getting to those calls in just a couple of minutes. First of all, Kimberly, Amelia mentioned this law that has now been passed, right? Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what has happened sort of on the legislative front with regard to this issue.
I think Mike Taylor's going to be a better source for you on that.
All right, go ahead, Mike.
Well,
she just kicked
food safety,
it to you.
I love the opportunity to talk about the Food Safety Modernization Act. This was enacted in 2011 in response to outbreaks of foodborne illness associated with a wide variety of food commodities, produce commodities, very visible peanut butter outbreaks, a wide array of concerns. And so it's an effort to really modernize the way in which the food industry and FDA work to prevent these problems. So it's a sweeping overhaul of our food safety system focused primarily on reducing the risk associated with bad bacteria in food.
Okay. Eric Olson, we've been talking so far in very general terms. Let's just for a minute zero in on a couple of additives that might be problematic. I know that some food safety advocates are concerned about foods that contain corn. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Tell us about what that
well,
is.
Well, corn, it's spelled with a Q,
yeah.
Is a protein that's made out of a form of fungus, basically. It's a mycoprotein, it's called. And there have been concerns and a lot of reports of people that have had allergic reactions, in some cases severe allergic reactions to this chemical being in their food. And that I think it's just an illustration of why we really need to modernize this law, because we need a reporting scheme, we need an information gathering authority for FDA. What hasn't been mentioned is FDA doesn't really have clear authority to order companies to do testing or to order companies to supply data, as many other regulatory agencies do in other contexts. So that's one example that just illustrates the massive shortcomings of the current regulatory scheme that really need to be updated. And in response to the question about the lack of resources for FDA, we totally agree that's a mm-hmm. serious problem. We actually have proposed that there be a fee system where the industry would pay a small fee in order to get FDA to approve their food additives. Just as the drug industry pays FDA to review the safety of drugs, the pesticide industry pays EPA to review the safety of pesticides, we think we ought to have the same kind of scheme for chemicals being added to the food supply.
Now, you say chemicals, but some of the additives are actually organic, right? And, you know, I want to talk for a minute, maybe when we come back after a break, about carrageenan, which is not a chemical additive, but yet there's some issues around it, right, Amelia?
I don't believe there's any issues. It has been determined to be
safe. Made from seaweed.
Yes, it's a seaweed product. It's been in the food supply for years.
Well, there may be debate about that. I do want to get back after the break to talk about some of these individual additives that are sneaking into the food supply without, according to food safety advocates, without adequate supervision or publicly available research about their impact. My guests are Michael Taylor, he's Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine, the Food and Drug Administration, Kimberly Kindy, a national reporter with the Washington Post, Eric Olson, the Senior Strategic Director for the Health and Food at the National Natural Resources Defense Council, and Emilia Leonardo, Vice President of Consumer Product Safety and Science Policy for the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Lots of callers have with specific questions about additives they're concerned about. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go straight to the phones. Stay tuned.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, a proud sponsor of NPR for 7 years, offering online and email marketing tools. More at ConstantContact.com. By Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at CancerCenter.com. And by CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks, online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, The Terrorist Son. Zach Ibrahim was 7 years old when his father, El Said Nosseir, assassinated the ultra-Orthodox militant Rabbi Meir Kahane. While in prison, Ibrahim's father helped mastermind the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Ibrahim has written a new memoir and is an advocate for peace and nonviolence. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton. This is the Diane Rehm Show. I'm sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about food additives in the food supply and the oversight of the process by which those ingredients are added with my guests, Michael Taylor from the FDA, Kimberly Kindy from the Washington Post, Eric Olson from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Emilia Leonardo from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And Kimberly, right before the break, we were talking about carrageenan and corn, but there are some better-known ingredients that are, in fact, controversial and around which there are issues about whether more research should have been disclosed about their health effects. You mentioned caffeine, for example.
Right. So that's a really good example of the FDA determining that something is generally recognized as safe, but in a very limited way. They said it's okay for it to be put in sodas. But what has happened in recent years is something that is very dangerous. The FDA had to go after beverage companies that were putting caffeine in alcoholic beverages, marketing it to kids, and kids were dying. The companies are going off on their own and making these determinations that caffeine is generally recognized as safe, that it's okay to put it in things that are marketed to kids, marshmallows, waffles, caffeinated waffles, they're on the market. And the amount of overload on caffeine that is happening with kids is extremely dangerous.
Amelia, what would be the reason for putting caffeine in marshmallows?
I'm sorry, I don't really...
You didn't know that caffeine was in marshmallows.
No, I am aware. It is not one of our members, so I can't really speak to why someone would put caffeine in a marshmallow.
Well, can you talk about the use of caffeine more generally in a variety of foods, whether it's marshmallows or waffles or anything else?
Yes. Caffeine at particular levels are safe in food. The FDA, the IOM have studied caffeine. Caffeine has been in our food supply, naturally occurring in numerous plants, coffee, cocoa, and it is safe to be consumed at particular levels.
Particular levels. That's an important point.
As with all ingredients, it needs to be in the food supply. It needs to be in as an additive for a particular use at a particular level, and that determines the generally recognized as safe. If there are companies that are not following the generally recognized as safe criteria for caffeine added to food, FDA should go after those companies.
Well, I think that what we're going to find as we engage in this discussion is that the key word in that recognized as safe phrase is generally, because how general really is that recognition that these additives are safe? I want to go now to Patrick, who's on the line from East Lansing, Michigan. Hello, Patrick. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question about food dyes, and I just got into this because my brother-in-law got a PhD in biochemistry, and he's an eye surgeon now, but a medical doctor. But 25 years later, he was just having a holiday meal with his professor who was researching food dyes and their cancer-causing properties, and he came back and told us all the stuff that this gentleman had learned in the last 15 years over food dyes and cancer. So I started wondering about it, and stumbled onto the fact that the Subway sandwich that I eat with my veggie sub has this azo diacarbonide that is what gives the air to the yoga mats, and started to follow the fact that my daughter's eating it in her craft. There's other dyes similar to this one. This is a food additive. The yellow dyes in my daughter's Kraft mac and cheese was causing a problem, and then there was this caramel coloring dye that Consumer Reports was talking about. And in each of those cases, Subway faced a huge boycott and blogger campaign and got rid of the azo diacarbonide. The Kraft mac and cheese faced a huge boycott and got rid of the yellow dyes, and the caramel coloring came out of a bunch of sodas. And I was unclear where the FDA was and where the research was. So my real question is, since I was talking to a primary researcher through my brother-in-law and realizing how much research there was on the hazardous properties, you know, Europe banned it, Australia banned it. It causes allergies and asthma. My daughter is deathly allergic and has been in the hospital twice for asthma. So I just wonder, what's the research on the food dyes that's at war with the permissive use of them widely in the food supply?
Okay. Well, we have someone from the FDA here, Michael Taylor. First of all, before you answer that, Michael, what's interesting to me and what Patrick just said is that you've had cases where consumers have just bypassed the FDA, found the research on their own, mounted boycott campaigns, and gotten action taken by companies. The FDA is out of the loop in that process.
Look, and the consumer is sovereign in our food system, as it should be, and that's one way in which consumers act on the food system.
But what about the question? Let's talk about the particular question that Patrick had, which is food dyes.
Well, that's an interesting question because the way Congress set up the law, interestingly, there is a separate statute that governs FDA approval of color additives, food dyes. That law does not have this generally recognized as safe exception. So if a substance imparts color to food, it's required to come to FDA. So we actually know a lot about the colors that are added to food. And, you know, we're aware of the sensitivity issue around some of the food dyes. We've looked at that. We've convened expert advisory committees. You know, that's something that is on our radar screen, but it's based upon a lot of information as opposed to ignorance about the issue.
Eric Olson, do you have a comment there?
Yes. We are concerned about some of the artificial food colorings. Some of them have been suggested to be linked to behavioral issues with children that are fed them. And this is another case where, although FDA theoretically is supposed to approve these, many of them were approved many years ago. FDA doesn't have the resources, frankly, to go back and do a comprehensive review of some of them. FDA doesn't have the authority to mandate additional testing. So, again, it highlights some of the problems where we're often eating chemicals in our food supply based on very old information or data that's never made public.
Let's go now to Ted, who's on the line from Clearwater, Florida. Hello, Ted. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, and good morning. Now, several years ago, and this is, I guess, along the lines of your previous caller who had mentioned Subway, but I worked for a local commercial bakery here who sold primarily to bars, restaurants, and so forth. And one of their ingredients, and I've since found the name since I spoke to your screener, that they used was ADA, or azoleocarbonamide, somewhere along those lines, which is an ingredient in the making of rubber mats for automobiles and other plastic products. This particular ingredient has long been banned around the world, and not only banned, but in several countries, you're looking at, I think it was a $200,000 fine for using it in your product, and in some cases, jail time.
Well, I think that's probably the same ingredient the previous caller was talking about. He said it was used in yoga mats.
Yes, so Subway uses it as well, or they did. I think it's been recently banned here. But when you go into these places, you have no idea what the ingredients are that they're using. So I'm wondering, how can this happen? How can they be allowed to do that for so many years?
Well, what is what's the answer to that? Why is it, Emilio Lozano, why is it that, there seem to be stricter standards in other – is this true that there are stricter standards in other countries than here in the United States?
I can't speak to the standards in various countries. I know that here in the U.S., the generally recognized as safe criteria, if done according to the regulations and the law, has safe produces safe ingredients. So, FDA has oversight. The experts within the companies and the hired experts review all of the information. These are board-certified toxicologists who determine the safety of the ingredients. And you also have to remember the dose is extremely important. So if you have ingredients that have a particular function that's placed in food at de minimis levels, there's no safety hazard at that level. If you add it above and beyond the safety levels, then you will have an issue, but that's not what GRAS is about.
Let's go now to Christina, who's on the line from Baltimore. Hello, Christina.
Hi there. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Great. I just kind of wanted to make the comment that, a lot of people really rely on the FDA or really the masses to educate themselves on what's in food. And I just think it's really important to do your own researching to kind of find out that eating whole foods is best for you. You know, you can make foods very simply by just getting ingredients that come from the vegetables, tomatoes. You can make your own pasta. You don't really have to buy, processed foods. And the blame is really going on, I think, the FDA a lot and these big companies because they're maybe steering you wrong. But if you do your own research by simply going online, there's a lot of web pages, a lot of blogs, a lot of things like that where you can kind of educate yourself and make your own choices based on what you find there.
Well, Christine, in fact, I think it was Patrick earlier who pointed out that sometimes additives have been taken out of the food supply precisely in response to consumer pressure. So that reinforces your point. Eric Olson, you have a comment.
I do. I would agree that certainly there are things consumers can do to eat less processed foods or to eat foods that are straight out of the garden. But the problem is that the vast majority of food Americans eat is processed food or packaged food. And For now, we don't have a system that's ensuring that protection. With respect to other countries, no other country in the world has a generally recognized a safe exception where companies can just introduce a new additive without any governmental review. So we are definitely bringing up the rear in terms of safety reviews in the United States.
It's an interesting question. It was emailed in from Steve in Potomac, Maryland. He's wondering why are there no ingredient labels on beer? Craft beers have all sorts of ingredients, and yet they're not identified on the label. Craft beer has really taken off, Michael Taylor. Why are the ingredients not listed on beer bottles?
Yeah. This is going to sound bureaucratic, but interestingly, TTB, the agency in the Department of Treasury that regulates alcoholic beverages, regulates the labeling of alcoholic beverages.
And so that's outside your jurisdiction?
That's outside our jurisdiction.
But it's food. I mean, it's people take in. You would think that...
There's been litigation and a court decided that they have the authority and we don't.
And David from Greensboro, North Carolina, is wondering, he writes, assuming that each company does proper research in its own bailiwick, does anyone do overarching research to bring all this together? If company A finds its product safe and company B does the same, does anyone conduct research to find out if there are any interactions between these products when ingested in the human body at essentially the same time? Now, that's an interesting question. I'm going to put that to you, Amelia, after we remind our listeners that this is the Diane Rehm Show. But that is a clear scenario where some kind of overarching research capability is needed. It's not just a matter of ingredient A, ingredient B, ingredient C.
That's a very interesting question. We have not looked at interactions very similar to interactions with drug ingredients in terms of food ingredients. There has not been a public health issue that I am aware of in terms of the combination of ingredients in the food supply. And I'm certain if there was an issue that FDA would identify that issue and handle the safety.
Let's go now to Tyler, who's on the line from Louisiana. Hello, Tyler. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, I was really hoping I'd get to my question, so I'm glad to
hear you.
Go. Thank you. It's for GMA Amelia. I just had a really quick question. I understand that you're very for transparency when it comes to all these food additives, yet the GMA is very against labeling genetically modified foods for the population, and they spent a lot of money trying to make sure it didn't get on the ballots in a few states and didn't pass. So I'm curious on where the line is drawn for transparency when it comes to things. If you think it's safe, why would you not want to let people know what's in their food? And I'll take my shot. Thank you.
Thank you, Tyler. A lot of questions, actually. We're not going to be able to get to them all about genetically modified additives. Do you want to take that question on?
Well, thank you very much. I'm not prepared to speak on genetically modified food. I know that FDA has determined that there is no difference between genetically modified as well as inherent products. But I'm not really prepared to speak on genetically modified organisms today. We're here to talk about food additives.
Eric, you're willing to talk about
it. I am willing to talk about it. Let me just first say that we're not necessarily – our belief is not that genetically modified food is going to make you sick from eating it after it's processed. We're not saying that. But we do believe that consumers have a right to know about whether their food has been produced with genetically modified organisms. So we think it's a right-to-know issue. And often one of the big issues here is that most of these genetically modified organisms that are used in food crops are being used because the crops are resistant to herbicides. So vast increases in herbicides like Roundup have resulted from the use of those. And consumers ought to be able to choose for or against those.
Okay, we're just about out of time, but Kimberly, just look ahead here a little bit. What do you see happening? I know that there is the Center for Food Safety is suing the FDA. There's talk about legislation on Capitol Hill, new legislation. Where do you see this issue going in the next few weeks or months?
Well, I know that the FDA is looking at potential reforms. one of the reforms that a lot of people are talking about, and this would require Congress stepping up to the plate and doing something, would be to make sure that they have what they need if food companies are ordered to let them know, notify them about generally recognized as safe determinations. In order for them to review those determinations, they have to have staff. And a lot of people are talking about it should reflect kind of what happens with the drug world. If you want something new out there as a drug, you have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. You have to pay for that review. And so there's a lot of talk about that. And I think that there's going to be a lot of discussion on the Hill about whether or not there's going to be some members who are going to be bold enough to take on the food industry and propose that.
Kimberly Kindy is a reporter from The Washington Post. My other guests for this discussion of food additives and the FDA's role in overseeing them, Michael Taylor from the FDA, Eric Olson from the Natural Resources Defense Council, Emilia Leonardo from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Thank you all for coming in. I'm Tom Gelton. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurblifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zurich.